Welcome back to the Airplane Geeks podcast. This is episode 52. I'm Max Flight, and with me is our co-host tonight, Dan Webb. Hello, Dan.
Good evening, Max. Hello, everyone.
And our other new co-host, Rob Mark, is unfortunately, well, fortunately for him, is in Paris for the air show. And we were going to try to hook up with him for this episode, but it wasn't going to fit with his schedule. So Rob will be joining us next week. So for this episode, it's myself and Dan. Our guest later on will be Paula Berg. She's the manager of emerging media for Southwest Airlines. We've got a great little discussion we had with Paula. You can listen to that coming up after we do the news. So let's launch with that. Dan, ready for the news?
Oh, yeah.
Our first story comes from Bloomberg. This is American Air to slash 1,600 jobs. Delta may follow. AMR Corp's American Airlines will eliminate 1,600 jobs, and Delta Airlines may pare its payroll again as waning travel demand spurs deeper cuts in seating capacity. American's reductions equal about 2.4% of the workforce, while Delta said it would reassess staffing needs without giving a figure. U.S. Airways said it wants 400 flight attendants to take leaves, or it will result to layoffs. So, Dan, we're seeing still kind of a soft market for air travel.
Well, it's definitely a scary time. I think we might have hit some kind of bottom. It doesn't seem like it's getting much worse. That being said, I mean, for the past few months, I think Continental's been saying their passenger revenue per ASM has been down, you know, around the 19% each month. So, still not great. The economy overall still not in good shape. And what's the problem is for airlines now, this recession, basically about a year ago, we were all talking about high oil prices. Right. And then we saw, you know, commodity prices come down a really big amount. So basically the airline industry traded weak demand, traded high oil prices for weak demand. But now oil's starting to creep up above $70 a barrel again. So now this is almost a really bad situation for the industry. And what's scary now is that we've seen already huge reductions. I mean, United, probably the biggest, getting rid of about 100 aircraft. And so now that we're going to see more capacity coming back, it's not good.
No, and I don't know if this is the extent of it or we'll be seeing other actions. In this article, they point out that U.S. Airways has said it has 6,700 attendants, which is too many. They were hoping that attrition would thin their ranks, but that's not happened. And so U.S. Airways is looking at capacity cuts of as much as 6%. They haven't announced any new reductions yet, but that may be just around the corner.
I think it's just a scary time overall. I mean, I don't think people are as fearful as they were a few months ago when we saw the Dow just constantly dropping. I think there was one day it was down over 700 points, but it's just a horrible time. And I think it's tough to be an airline executive right now because really, how do you plan for the future? We don't know when the economy is going to come back. You don't know exactly how the stimulus plan is going to work out. It's a confusing, scary time.
Speaking of the future, Biz Journals has our next story, which is Boeing sees $3.2 trillion market for planes over the next 20 years. Boeing releases a current market outlook each year, and their 2009 edition is out. The article says, despite the economic downturn, Boeing maintained the same $3.2 trillion 20-year forecast it released last year. It's down a little bit, but it's essentially flat. Boeing predicts passenger air traffic will grow at an average rate of 4.9% over the next 20 years, and cargo traffic will grow at 5.4% annually, and that's down slightly from last year's 20-year outlook. So 20 years is a long time horizon, but the Boeing outlook at least doesn't predict any near-term, large drop.
Well, at least their forecasters are seeing that they think this recession will eventually see a recovery and will eventually see return to a growth period, which would be absolutely fantastic.
It's what everyone wants. I guess the question is, is it optimistic thinking, or is it, you know, grounded in sound economic forecasts?
Right. Well, you never know. Obviously, the company wants to put out a positive image, but I think eventually you're going to have to see new planes. I think one issue is how many are just going to be providing growth and how many will be just replacements.
Right.
Well, and I think because I think if we continue to see oil rise, I think that could put some pressures on airlines to renew their fleets, get some more efficient aircraft. But what I found interesting is that they found that there'll be a good amount of orders for single aisle planes, about 1.4 trillion. A lot more planes than the wide bodies, but worth a little bit less in terms of orders. So even the $1.4 trillion is still a good amount of orders. I'm just wondering when we'll start hearing more from Boeing on a 737 replacement.
Yeah, you're right. The next generation single aisle is kind of an open question, both for Boeing and for Airbus as a potential A320 series replacement. The numbers are interesting, and you mentioned a little bit of that the Boeing's forecast on a dollar basis is greater for twin aisle planes, than single aisle. But in terms of number of aircraft, the forecast is much higher for single aisle planes. The prediction is for single aisle is 19,460 planes versus twin aisle wide body planes to 6,700. So it's over twice, almost three times the number of single aisle planes. So that mix is very critical and interesting for the future, as you mentioned, because it's gonna drive what Boeing and what Airbus do with their next generation single aisle.
Well, I think we'll just have to wait and see, because I think the airlines eventually are going to put pressure on them. I mean, the A320 and the 737, I think they still have a few years left, but eventually I think some major carriers are going to start asking for a replacement. And I think eventually, I mean, looking down many years down the pike, because they're still getting new 700s, but eventually Southwest is going to have to replace their 737s, and that's a huge order.
Yes.
That could make the line big. And still, I mean, the 737, I think, is still the most successful commercial aircraft in terms of orders. So eventually there's going to have to be a replacement. So, but I think what's going to be interesting in this situation is where the C series falls into it.
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of obviously a new class for Bombardier. People have high hopes for it. Certainly Bombardier does, and a lot of others do as well. And they could be the spoiler perhaps in what we see going forward with single aisle planes.
Well, I think they have a good opportunity here because Boeing's busy getting the 787 ready, and then the 7478, and then Airbus is, you know, the A380 is going pretty good at this point, but the A350 is now their big project.
Yeah, it's in this industry, it's often a matter of timing, and timing is sometimes deliberate, but many times just a matter of luck.
Yep.
But if you've got it, you'll take it, regardless of how it comes about. Our next story comes from Air Transport World. This is United Defends liquidity position moves carefully on fleet renewal. And you'll recall this relates to Boeing's recent announcement of an RFP to, United's recent announcement of an RFP to Boeing and Airbus for 100 aircraft. This article says that the RFP submitted is for fleet renewal, according to United, and not growth. And United expressed confidence that it will be able to finance any order it places. Notably, the carrier's credit facility rating was downgraded earlier this week by Fitch Ratings, which cautioned that United Airlines faces a deepening liquidity crisis and questioned its ability to finance a large long-haul aircraft order.
Well, I like reading about this order. It's definitely a very interesting story. But I do like I found interesting what Tilton said when he said, we have time, there's no urgency to place an order. And I think they're just going to take this their sweet time on this one, because I'm really not sure when they want these new aircraft to be delivered, because you'd think it'd be a long-term decision, because right now United's busy reconfiguring all their new international aircraft with new interiors, and I'm figuring when they made that decision, they wanted to get a few years out of it.
Yeah, you think.
But, I mean, definitely the downgrading of rating is not good when you want to get financing. They're not the only ones down that low. They were downgraded from B- to CCC, and I believe U.S. Airways and American are down at CCC as well, and pretty much most of the airlines are down near the junk bonds. I'm not sure about this one, but I think right now the only major carrier with an investment-grade rating is Southwest. So this is just not just United's problems. Everyone has a bad rating, it seems.
Yeah, and that certainly is going to affect what's possible in terms of aircraft acquisition or fleet renewal. Dan, you pointed out Brett Snyder's blog posting that Brett's obviously, as everyone knows, from the Cranky Flyer, but in his BNet post titled "Skepticism Surrounds Potential United Aircraft Order," Brett says that by now you've likely heard that United has sent out a request for proposal to replace its wide-body and 757 fleets for an airline that has refrained from ordering new aircraft for years, often enduring skepticism in the press. This is big news, but this plan has already drawn plenty of criticism, and many aren't expecting to ever see this order materialize.
Right, and one thing I found interesting in his blog post, he references a Plane Business, which is a subscription publication, but he says, this week's Plane Business proposes that United is trying to pit Airbus versus Boeing so they can get some cash up front in exchange for a big order. This would help build up that cash balance to get them through the winter, which, I find very interesting, because United, I mean, all the airlines need cash right now. This is definitely a creative way. And we'll have to see what United's strategy is. I mean, recently, U.S. Airways and JetBlue have both been putting out stock and bonds to try to raise some cash. So for United, we'll just have to see how it plays out. But I'm sure there might be some interesting discussions going on in Paris this week.
Yeah, no doubt. Okay, moving on. We have from airlinequality.com an interesting news item. Incheon International Airport is named World's Best Airport 2009. This Seoul, South Korean airport was named the world's best airport in 2009 in the World Airport Awards published by Skytrax. This is goes on to say, the most prolific World's Best Airport winner in recent years. The Hong Kong International Airport was pipped into second place by Incheon International, with Singapore Changi Airport ranking third best in the world, according to the latest passenger satisfaction ratings. This is an annual award that's based on questionnaires received from air travelers. In this case, 8.6 million questionnaires that were completed by passengers in 2008 and 2009. It covered more than 190 airports worldwide, and the survey evaluates traveler experiences across 39 different airport service and product factors, from check-in, arrivals, transfer, through to departure at the gate. So, interestingly enough, the top three are all Asian airports.
And what's also interesting, those top three in its 2008 rankings, they were also in the top three. They just moved around a little.
They changed the order. That's right. Just for, you might be interested, they're followed by fourth place was Zurich, fifth was Munich, sixth Kansai, seven Kuala Lumpur, that's in Malaysia, eighth was Amsterdam, ninth was Nagoya, and 10th, Auckland. Notably missing from the top 10, anything in North America.
Right, and you constantly hear that, airports, especially American airports, are nowhere near the quality of international airports. And I think that is a valid argument, but at the same time, I think there's a difference, because I think in some of these regions, aviation has really flourished in the past 20 years. Whereas America, up here in North America, we've had a more developed aviation industry for a long time. But still, I still think there's definitely some catch-up to be played. And I think some airlines are realizing the importance of a good airport environment. Most recently, JetBlue is opening their new terminal in JFK.
Yeah, when you know, I'm curious, Dan. When you walk into an airport, when you're about to experience, you know, the joys of a large airport, what are the things that are most important to you? I mean, if you were taking this survey, what would have been your, you know, big items?
Well, I'm sure it's not an item on the survey, but as a geek, I look for, you know, good spotting places from within the terminal.
Sure, but, I understand that.
But I mean, from a travel perspective, it's not everything's the airport's responsibility. A lot of it is the airline's responsibility when it comes to check-in time and stuff like that. But I'm always looking for a good security checkpoint. And I think some airports have a good amount of control over that. Like my local airport, Providence, just expanded their checkpoint, which really lowers waiting time, which is great. I really like it when airports have very good food and retail options. I don't think that's maybe a big deal for small airports, but I think hub airports should really right. focus on that for people that have long layovers.
I think that's an area that's really developed. It's big business. I think we reported in a very early episode of Airplane Geeks the annual revenue derived by airports from the retail sales operations. I don't remember the number, but it was huge. It was billions and billions of dollars. It's a very 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 profitable and important part of the airport business model. And you know, it does impact the experience you have there as a traveler in many situations. I find on most of my airport time is spent on business trips, probably more than personal trips. And one of the things that's important to me is being able to have the facilities that let me, you know, charge my equipment, or they're conducive to, you know, getting online and you know, getting a little bit of work done, checking up on email, things like that. But, you know, otherwise, I agree with what you said at the beginning, that being able to get some good views is really important.
Yeah. Well, I think it also depends who's running the airport in terms of if they're originating from the airport, because they're going to look at things like parking and check-in, or if it's a hub airport where people are connecting. And in that case, I'm going to look for things like if it's a long walk, you know, is there an airport train? Are there plenty of moving walkways? Is there good signage? So, or in the case if it's an international airport, is it easy to get to customs? Is customs relatively quick? Right. Things like that.
Okay, good. Let's move on to next topic, which comes from the BBC. This is Family Joins Air France Jet Probe. Relatives of a victim of the Air France crash have joined a manslaughter investigation as a plaintiff in an effort to access files on the case. A lawyer for the family said that some of the relatives thought information was being withheld. The Paris prosecutor's office launched the investigation last week, a step automatically taken after the death of French citizens overseas. You know, I can understand the families of the victims looking for information and, you know, reasons behind the tragedy that impacted them so directly. This does seem to center around them looking for information, and I mean we're still awfully early in the investigative process, and the information is the facts are still coming out each day.
Well, it's not just that, but it's even with the facts that they have, they're. From what the articles I've been reading, there are a few different theories you can draw from that same right. fact. So if it's, well, is there a loss in cabin pressure? Well, what was the cause of that? I just think it's a way too early. And I think, you know, if this story came out 6-12 months from now, then I would understand it more. But at this point, I think it's a bit too early.
Yeah, I agree completely. One of the interesting things that I've done with this accident is to sort of pay attention to how the theories change over time as more facts come out, or as things that were originally reported as facts turn out to be untrue and change. There's always someone eager to, you know, provide theories as to, you know, what happened, but it's just entirely too early in the process to really draw any conclusions. So I agree. I think in terms of a lawsuit activity, it seems kind of premature.
And I mean, at this point, when the flight data recorders are still yet to be found, I mean, hopefully they will find them before the batteries and those pingers die. But
right.
Right now, I just think there are more questions than answers. And, you know, unfortunately, people just have to wait.
A very interesting piece came out written by Patrick Smith.
It was a great column every week.
He really does. This is in Salon.com. This is titled Flight 447's Perfect Storm. Now, Patrick Smith is a pilot who flies this area and has some experience with it. He says the gist of this accident appears pretty clear. Air France Flight 447 was victimized by a terrible storm. How the airplane got into the storm and what exactly happened once it got there are two fascinating, if perhaps unanswerable, questions. The plane's flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder, the proverbial black boxes, are apparently lodged amid undersea mountains beneath thousands of feet of water. They may stay there forever. And so we are left to speculate as to how an experienced crew at the controls of a $100 million jetliner could have found itself in such deadly circumstances. He shows the graphic that I think we mentioned before. There's some work has been done to pull together by weathergraphics.com to pull together data surrounding the storm at the time, overlaying the flight path of the Air France A330, you know, through that storm. And he has some very interesting things to say about what he sees. He notes that, you know, these pilots are very well trained to avoid thunderstorms. You don't fly deliberately into a thunderstorm, particularly one that's got areas that are as severe as this. But that, you know, you may sort of try to thread the needle at times, because in this particular region, the path around a large thunderstorm can be, you know, quite long. And maybe that's what happened here, that, you know, in trying to thread that needle, as it were, maybe there was a series of events that together conspired to impact this flight. Again, he says, my hunch is that unusually potent lightning strike set off a cavalcade of serious electrical problems. According to the automatic status messages relayed from the airplane to its maintenance staff in Paris, the plane suffered a loss of its air data inertial reference unit and integrated standby instrument system. Other messages told of degraded condition of the jet's high-tech fly-by-wire flight control system, evidently triggered by multiple electrical faults and what seems to have been a loss of cabin pressure. But those are just all observations and not causes.
Right.
We have this little bit of data, but that's it at this point. So it's really hard to say. With us today is Paula Berg. She's the manager of emerging media with Southwest Airlines. We're really delighted to have Paula with us. Paula, thanks for being here.
Howdy. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Paula, Southwest Airlines has got quite an online presence, maybe even more than some of the other airlines. Why is that? What is Southwest Airlines trying to accomplish?
That's a good question. I don't know if we really knew when we got started. You know, Southwest is a company that has always valued customer communication for 38 years. You know, for as long as, you know, you can remember, if you wrote to us, you got a personalized research letter in response. If you call us, you get a human being on the phone. So this really wasn't a big leap for us. It was sort of just a new avenue for us to keep doing what we've always done.
Was it a tough sell to get started, or, you know, was it part of a grand strategy, or is it top down or bottom up?
You know, it's funny. It was a really easy sell. I joke that, like, we had complete sign off for our executives. I just don't think they had any idea what they had really signed off at the time, because, you know, it was 4 years ago that we really started to, that we really got permission to launch our blog. And at that time, it was really, There weren't a lot of other companies doing this, and blog was still, that was not a word that everyone, you know, in corporate America was using on a daily basis. But do you remember the TV show Airline that we did with A&E?
Yes.
Okay, well, that show, a lot of people don't realize this, but that show had, we had no editorial control of that show. We could suggest voiceover work to sort of to clarify a situation, but really that was, it was out of our hands. So when that show went off the air, we were sort of looking around for, you know, how do we fill that void? Because it had been so successful for us. We had, every Monday after the show would air, job applications would triple, and really? And revenue we would go. Is that crazy? So the show went off the air. We were really looking around. Well, now what? And that's right when the blogosphere was really percolating. And so we just dove in headfirst, not necessarily knowing what we were getting into. Our strategy at the time was really a replacement for that show, to just kind of let people, you know, peek behind the curtain, connect with our employees. But it's really evolved to be so much more. You know, it's a virtual focus group. It's a place for us to make and break news. It's a place for us to tell the rest of the story when our friends in the media don't have the time or the space to get all the backstory in. And we just are in love with it, and we're letting it sort of guide us and lead us, and learning what it can, more and more about what it can do every day.
The volume of you know, travelers and potential customers, you know, watching you, I think is pretty significant. I think I saw the other day that you mentioned on Twitter that you just crossed 50,000 followers on Twitter. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, it's been, you know, it's funny. We've been on Twitter since July of 07, which is, you know, way back, and that nobody was really, there weren't a whole lot of people there at the time. And so we were able to really play around with it when no one was looking and just kind of figure out what we were doing. And then it slowly just started, as you both know, just picking up and picking up. And it's been averaging about 100 new followers a day. And it's, you know, Twitter's a blast. Yeah, it's fantastic. And the beauty of it is, it's people that want to be communicating with you. You know, they're people that specifically decide that they want to be there. So, you know, it's not intruding on them. It's communication that's invited and welcome, and that makes it fun.
Paula, was there any time when you said management, you know, signed off on it but didn't really know what they were signing off on, maybe? Mm-hmm. Was there a time when management really realized the power of new media?
Yeah. In my mind, there was a clear moment, and it was when we were doing the assigned seating test in San Diego. As you know, you guys are familiar with our open seating policy, and you know, for years we'd get letters from people that say, you know, I love your fares, I love your schedules, I love your good service, but I hate that crazy open seating policy, and I'm not going to fly you. And so finally, you know, and we would evaluate assigned seating over the years, but, you know, we felt strongly that our open seating is the most efficient policy. And even though we sort of, you know, we'd say that, we sort of have our heads hang low and say, well, you know you don't like it, but it's efficient and we can operate more flights, and so we can offer lower fares. So we finally decided, you know, if there's so many in this challenging revenue environment, if there's so many people that don't want to fly us because of that, perhaps we should seriously test and consider changing. And if we can be as efficient as we are now with that system, maybe perhaps we'll make that change. And Gary Kelly, our CEO, wrote a blog post, I believe it was titled Open Season on Assigned Seating. And it immediately got like 700 comments, which was our first real flood of comments since we'd gotten on the blog. It had been, you know, slow starting, as every blog is. And the crazy thing was, like 80% of them said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I love your open seating policy. It's the only thing that makes you different from the other carriers. And it's why I fly you. And if you change, you know, who will I fly? And then they said, well, you know, it's not your open seating that I don't like. It's your crazy boarding process. And here are some suggestions to fix it. And, you know, we were able to take those back to the teams that were testing it. But I think that was really the first moment when everyone thought, you know, perhaps there's something to this blogging thing everyone's talking about. And I think it really changed the internal debate around assigned seating and open seating for us. It didn't, you know, it wasn't the deciding factor, but it definitely influenced the discussion.
That's pretty fascinating. I know, you know, some large companies, when they're, you know, thinking about entering into the sort of new media arena, sometimes they get nervous that, you know, they don't completely have control over the discussion, that you know, people can say negative things about the company or, you know, other undesirable things. And it's just not as controlled as sort of traditional media. Have you encountered that at all in your experiences with Southwest? Have there been customers that have just said, you know, crazy things that are difficult to deal with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it can get tough out there. You know, you got to have a thick skin. But I think we came from the beliefs that you never really had control. And you know, better to engage. These conversations are going on. If you can't control them, you can at least be a part of them and get out there and in some cases, in fact, lead them. And I got to say that there have been some white knuckle moments, as I call them, some times when it has been real rough going and hot issues where we've taken a lot of criticism and heat and personal attacks. But when I look back over the last 3 years, those are my favorite times. You know, I look back and I think, man, that's when you really see what this stuff can do, what social media is all about and the power of it. And so so now when those situations kind of arise, I just, you know, put my hair back in a ponytail and roll up my sleeves and get ready. You know, that's when the magic happens. You know?
Now, Paul, as a blogger of myself, I've noticed that Southwest has been very good about getting back to me with questions, and it seems as I read other aviation blogs out there, I'm not the only one, and it seems that you guys have been a lot nicer to bloggers than other carriers. Why do you see that as important? Why do you constantly communicate with people that way?
Well, again, I think it's the same philosophy as with our customers. And, you know, I came out of a PR school, and actually I started in customer relations, and the philosophy at Southwest is everybody gets a call back. Everybody gets a letter back, whatever, you know, there's no message that goes unreturned. And that doesn't matter who you're, a reporter or a blogger or a customer. That's the philosophy here. And so I learned that in customer relations. I learned it in public relations. And when I moved on to start working in social media, those same philosophies applied. And I would also say that, you know, it was 4 years ago, we were just learning about it. And who were some of the most helpful people were the people that were out there doing it. And they really opened us with, welcomed us with open arms and helped show us the way. And the truth is, God, who in this world do I have more in common with than the people that are writing about airlines and blogging? I mean, that's all I think about. So I think of us as like this small group of people that should be pretty close.
Now, Paula, you have the blog, the Nuts About Southwest blog. And Southwest is on Twitter. Where else?
So we've got the blog since April of 06 and Twitter since July of 07. We're also on Facebook, which we're having a lot of fun with, particularly since Facebook's made some changes to make communication a little easier on there. YouTube, we have a channel there that videos become a real focus for us. And Flickr as well, you know, with plane spotters and so many people out there. Photographing aircraft, you know, the famous photo out the window of the wing, we get a lot of those. So that's been a nice place to sort of share. For years, people would send us those photos and we didn't really have anything to do with them. And now we have this great Flickr feed that feeds into our homepage of our blog where we can feature people's stuff. So those are our main hubs. And then, of course, we're active on other, you know, aviation forums and other blogs and try to just follow conversations and participate whenever we can or when it's appropriate. Without being creepy, you know, sure. There's sometimes it's just kind of a gut check where you're like, should I respond to this or just let it go? I don't know.
Yeah, there can be a fine line. How many people are doing this? It's not just you.
No, it's not just me now, which is great. We, we started, it was me and my colleague, Brian Lesk, and the yin to my yang in social media and our social media efforts at Southwest. And for a couple of years, it was just us and we were doing our full-time jobs in addition to this. And we slowly started transitioning. And then I guess it was maybe about 2 years ago that I started doing this full-time. And then in August, we actually got our own team. And now we're the emerging media team. We are 7 people strong. We have a combined 60 years of Southwest experience in everything from ramp, in-flight, customer service, graphic design, reservations, just a little bit of almost every department in the company, which is great. It really strengthens our ability to communicate with our customers in a real honest and substantive way.
Sure, it sounds very exciting. Across all those different hubs, is it kind of a homogeneous, you know, collection of you know, communication points, or are there differences? Did you accomplish one thing on Twitter and a different thing on the blog? Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think each one has its own audience, and it's, I think there's overlap, but most of them have their own audience and their own voice and their own style and things they like to hear about. So our philosophy has been, well, I mean, the company message never changed. We're Southwest Airlines, you know, the message is the same, but we've allowed each of our folks on our team to own a channel. So Christy owns Twitter and Facebook, and Brian owns, you know, Flyer Talk. And so they are able to then take whatever the message is and relate it to their audience in the way that's most appropriate. They're, for the most part, uncensored and have the, you know, their trusted voices of the company to go out there and just talk about what's going on. So it's, you know, it's tough because it's a lot of work and a lot of time and commitment for them, you know, being that sole voice. But I think it's sort of the secret to making it work for us.
How effective do you think efforts like Twitter and Facebook, how effective do you think that is in attracting new customers and keeping customers?
You know, it's hard to say, you know, it's hard to really put, it's anecdotal for us right now. But you know, you do get messages that say things like, you know, thanks so much for reaching out to me. It really affects the way I view your company, and you'll be my first choice from now on. Or, you know, I'm flying Southwest again for the first time in years after having this communication with you. You do feel like it breeds a loyalty that you wouldn't have maybe if you weren't communicating there. I think time will tell, and we'll have to see. But again, it goes back to that philosophy that we have there, that customer communication is important. And we don't, fortunately, I work for a company that doesn't make us justify that on a daily basis or monthly or quarterly or anything. It's inherent in our business model to do that. And it's been successful for a pretty long time.
Paula, one thing I've noticed on Twitter is that some airlines predominantly seem to use their Twitter feed a lot of times just to broadcast specials for fares and discounts, but it doesn't seem that Southwest does that often. Can you explain why you choose to do that?
Yeah, it's not something we're opposed to, and I think you'll probably start to see more of it, but certainly all of our social media efforts were born out of communication. And so we really felt like it was important to treat those relationships and channels with respect and not come in there and try to just bully or be salespeople. And so that's what we've been doing. We've been laying that foundation and we've tried to let our audience guide us. So if our audience was telling us we want sales, we want this stuff, we'll do more of that. You know, you can look back on our blog when we first started and it was very culture heavy. You know, it was very much like, here we are at the chili cook-off. Here's why I love working at Southwest. You know, there's a lot of that stuff. And then you have these incidents like the open seating debate or like a new schedule opening. And we saw, wow, there was a huge traffic, you know, spike and interest in those. So we started writing more about those. We still write the culture stuff, but we're letting our audience guide us. And the same goes for, you know, fare sales and things like that. We're starting to do a little more. And if people are receptive, we'll keep doing it.
Yeah, that's very interesting what you say, Paula, about in effect, Southwest's participation in emerging media is a reflection of the culture at Southwest. It's not a part of a specifically articulated business plan with a specific return on investment. It's just a reflection of the culture, and I think that's refreshing. I think it speaks highly of Southwest, and for other companies that you know don't have that culture, you can see that that's reflected in their attempts at emerging media as well.
Oh yeah, my buddy Brian always says, you know, if your company doesn't have a strong or a positive culture, then you got bigger things to worry about than social media. You know, that perhaps you should focus on that.
All right, well, we want to make sure
before you dive into social media.
Exactly. Paula, we have something we want to make sure we have enough time for. It's a little thing we do called word association.
Oh boy!
So it's you
would
very
be graded.
Simple. Yeah.
Okay.
But this is actually the fun part. Dan and I each have three words or phrases, and we'll alternate, and you can just respond with the first thing that pops into your mind, and you can elaborate on it. Think of it as a conversation starter. It's very simple.
All right. Okay.
And the answers will be submitted to your boss.
Yeah. I'm nervous.
No, this is good. Dan, you want to start?
You don't know what goes on in this mind. Yeah.
my first one is hot pants.
Southwest Orange.
Okay. Anything more on that, or?
Oh, okay. I can keep going. I can do more. Oh gosh, is it? I can just throw one word, or you want like stories, or
no,
what?
If you have a story, that's great.
Feel free to explore.
When I think hot pants now, it reminds me of the Right Amendment fight, and we had a huge rally at our headquarters, and had tons of employees dressed up in the old hot pants. But it was funny because the uniforms were so tiny, we had to look for people that were small enough to fit into them. Yeah. You know, like there's no way I could ever squeeze into one of those things. But we had a huge rally with tons of flight attendants in the old uniforms, and a lot of, you know, all the signs and the posters, and it was, you know, one of those just real rally cry warrior spirit kind of moments at Southwest. And it's those kind of things that I think have, you know, unified us and built our culture over the years. You know, out of conflict has sort of driven our business model and our culture.
Hmm. Very good. Okay, my first word, followers.
Followers. Well, the first thing I think is not Southwest. You know, we're Southwest is in addition to Twitter, of course, but you know, Southwest is such a maverick company. And, you know, when other airlines, we try to do things different. We are not followers in this industry. And we try to blaze a trail. And whether that's, you know, point-to-point service versus hub, or, you know, the not, you know, trying to avoid charging fees to survive while other airlines are, you know, tacking those on left and right. We're a company that really tries to do things our own way. And I know even for our own, as we're working every day, when we're looking for inspiration, I rarely look at what our competitors are doing. You know, we look inside, we look at our own people, we look to Herb and Colleen and the history of the company. And I think that spirit is what drives.
The notion of, you know, being a maverick and leading the pack, is that something that, you know, people who work at Southwest are very conscious of, you know, kind of each and every day? Or is that something that just sort of results from the things that they do? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I think they're very cognizant of it on a daily basis. Absolutely. I mean, it's why I think it's part of why our employees are so happy. It's really nice to come to work, to be able to hold your head high, come to work and hold your head high, knowing that you work for a company that is trying to do the right thing, or that empowers you to do the right thing, and that has this really rich history. And yeah, I think everyone is very, very aware of it, which just makes it a great place to work.
Cool. Dan?
All right. My next phrase, because it's two words. Okay, you can cut that out because that sounds so stupid.
I'm leaving this all in, Dan.
Oh, great. Fantastic. Awesome. Okay, so my next one is it's on.
It's on. What do you think of the It's On campaign?
I'm a fan, personally. Got me excited.
Tell us about that campaign.
It's funny because anytime a new campaign comes out, you're kind of nervous. You know, you look at it, you're like, how is this going to resonate with people? And I've really fallen in love with it. And I think we all sort of want, I find myself like getting ready to go out. I'm like, it's on. Like I'm saying all those little, oh, your mom just called, it's on. I'm saying all those things from the commercial. And so, you know, it's definitely, I think, resonating with us internally. It is it is on. This is, we have to, you know, buckle up and get ready. There are tough times ahead, but we're not, you know, we gotta do what we need to do to stay strong and profitable for our employees and for our customers. And so I think it's a good rally cry for us internally, and I hope it resonates externally as well. It's gotten a really positive response, which is nice.
Good. My next word, rappers.
Rappers, you know, it's obviously David Holm, rapping flight attendant.
Yes.
I was at the Southwest annual awards banquet last night here in Dallas. 3,000 employees together for this event, and David came out and performed. And he's fantastic. He is so talented. And, you know, we've got his, obviously the rap that so many people saw on TV and YouTube, and then he came to our annual shareholders meeting and rapped about generally accepted accounting principles, which is hysterical. And then last night he performed, and it's just, you know, we've always known we have a million stars among us in our crews, but you know, it's nice when they get to shine for everyone to see like that. And he's really, I think he's really energized the base too. You know, people, there's a lot of buzz around the company about him.
All right. my final one is Wild Turkey.
Oh, man. Herb Kelleher. Wild Turkey. I think, are we the only company in America that has a corporate liquor? Like, that's hysterical to me. I love that. You know, there are so many, there are Wild Turkey things all along our walls. I'll never forget. We had a press conference. It was after shareholders meeting one year, actually. And I think the room we usually have it in was under construction. And so we had it in this sort of weird conference room that had a series of tables that were formed into a square. And in the middle of the square was this giant turkey, Wild Turkey. Yeah. And it's always there. It wasn't put there as a prop. It's just always there. And it's so funny. It's those kind of things that everyone is very aware of in the company. And they bring out certain images and a spirit in our employees. And it makes it fun. It makes it exciting. It's the fact that you could just say Wild Turkey to any employee and they would immediately muster up all these feelings of, warmth and love and for Herb and for our history is pretty cool.
It is. It's sort of a special thing you've got going there.
Well, my favorite is the Malice in Dallas video with Herb lifting the Wild Turkey bottles like barbells.
It's still, have you been to our headquarters, Dan?
I have not, unfortunately. One day it's going to happen.
Max, have you ever been?
No, I have not.
Well, when you guys come, I'll have to, if we can get you out there sometime, there's a whole wall that's it's like a live boxing ring with a giant boxing ring in front of the elevators with models of Herb and arm wrestling. So it's pretty fantastic. I'll show you, get your picture in front of it when you're there.
That sounds great. Okay, my final one, a phrase, like to get your thoughts on the kind of people that we like to call airplane geeks.
Oh, airplane geeks, such a term of endearment. it's funny because sometimes I use that phrase when I'm out and about speaking, and I think people that aren't familiar with it are sort of like, I think I'm being critical of of someone. But, I came to work for Southwest 8 years ago, and I will say that I did not have a big interest in the airline industry at that time. And for years, almost resented it would be going too far, but was sort of like, gosh, how did I end up working for an airline? What am I doing? And was kind of looking around. And then suddenly one day it just captured my heart and my mind. And I can't imagine doing anything else now. And I sort of got an understanding of what that means. And as I've met many of those airline geeks over the years and, Cranky Flyer, Dan Webb, Curve Crusher, these folks. I just have a real special place in my heart and hope to associate myself with that.
Yeah, it's certainly an industry that has a lot of passion.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, it's so corny, but I just love it. I love going to work every day. I love the industry. I love the people I work with. And I feel like a complete spaz when I say that, but God, pretty lucky gal to be able to do what I do for the company that I do it for. And in an industry that is just so, never a dull moment. There's never a dull moment or a slow day working in the airline industry.
Sounds like the perfect job.
Yeah.
Paula, tell us again, for our listeners, the address for the Southwest blog or any of the other sites that you want to make sure that people are aware of.
Oh, thanks so much. So our blog is Nuts About Southwest. You can find it at www.blogsouthwest.com or nutsaboutsouthwest.com. And then our Twitter handle is @SouthwestAir. And we're also on Facebook. We're pretty easy to find out there. And we'd love for you to join the conversation and help guide and shape our social media efforts moving forward.
Great. That's Paula Burke. She's the manager of emerging media for Southwest Airlines. Again, thank you for joining us, Paula.
Thanks, Paula.
Thanks so much. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, Dan now has a pick for this week.
Okay, so I went with chaviation.ch, which is a really fascinating aviation database. There are a few out there, but the great thing about this one, it's free. So my favorite feature is the fleet list feature, which is really updated very often. And you just basically find every single aircraft that an airline operates. And I just find stuff like that fascinating, just looking at each aircraft and, you know, finding the stats on that. So it's just a cool way to find out information about the world's airlines and the aircraft they operate. So I definitely think it's worth a visit at least once. So that's ch-aviation.ch.
This site has been around for a long time. I think around 10 years, maybe a little bit longer.
On their about page, it says it was started in 98, so yeah.
There we go. And it's I've always found it to have a huge amount of information in great detail. You can subscribe to a weekly newsletter that has that information in it. And it's a really great way to keep up on just absolutely everything going on with respect to fleets. So it's a great pick.
Well, thank you.
And now with aviation news from the only country that can call itself a continent, here's Steve Vischer with the Australia News Desk.
Dateline Melbourne, June
14th, 2009. G'day folks, I'm Steve Vischer at the Australia Desk, and with me is Grant. G'day Grant.
Hey Steve, how you doing, mate?
We're very good here, and we've survived another weekend, and we've got a number of stories here this week that we found interesting, so let's get stuck into it.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, this first story appeared in the Brisbane Courier Mail and various other news.com.au publications this week, probably the biggest story in Australia this week, and it involves a Jetstar Airlines A330-200 Airbus, which experienced a cockpit fire. And the article reads, a Jetstar flight from Japan to the Gold Coast has made an emergency landing in Guam after a cockpit window caught fire. All passengers and crew were safe and nobody was injured. The Australian Transport Safety Bureau has launched an investigation, and they sent a team off to Guam. The ATSB said in a statement, the aircraft was an A330-200 Airbus, Flight JQ20, which left Kansai International Airport just before 11 p.m. local time, and was carrying 186 adult passengers, 4 infants, 13 crew, which included 4 pilots. It's the same aircraft, obviously, as the Air France plane, same type of aircraft that was involved in the crash over the Atlantic last week. Jetstar said there was only a small number of Australians on board. The aircraft was carrying mainly Japanese nationals. The airline said almost 4 hours into the flight, smoke was seen in the cockpit, and moments later, the right-hand cockpit window caught fire. Jetstar spokeswoman said there was smoke in the cockpit and small flames were seen on the right-hand window. The pilots quickly extinguished the fire, which didn't extend to any other part of the cabin area. The aircraft diverted to Guam without incident and landed at 2:20 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. Passengers were put up in local hotels in Guam, and they'll be flown to Australia on another Jetstar aircraft the following morning. Aircraft engineers in Guam are currently inspecting the aircraft, and the only other part there was the only other comment that was made by Jetstar, apart from doing all the usual PR spin, was the fact that the aircraft was only 2 years old and will be having an extended stay in Guam until obviously they can find the cause of the fire.
Yeah, that's going to hurt them a little, leaving that aircraft sitting over there, not earning any money for them.
Yes, not only that, Jetstar, but we were talking last week about Jetstar obviously is part of the Qantas group, and they have been facing some increased scrutiny the last few years with regard to their maintenance practices, and yeah, that's not going to look so good for the Qantas group.
But as was pointed out recently, in another source, that part of the aircraft hadn't been touched or modified. It was original material as per installation. So there's no claims that it was dodgy maintenance overseas, which is quite often a claim you hear over here because Qantas has done a lot of outsourcing of their maintenance. Mm. And as soon as anything goes wrong, the general cry goes around, oh, the dodgy overseas people.
Yes, and Qantas is always very quick to point out these days when they have an incident that the aircraft was in fact not serviced anywhere else but here in Australia. And the other comment that I made in a Twitter post, and it's probably the same as many other people's thoughts, is it's obviously not good news for Airbus Industries, Grant.
No, it's been a pretty bad week all round for Airbus. There's been a few other incidents and the development further of the Air France crash. A lot of postings, I'll send them as a separate email actually, a lot of comments and postings and focusing on pedo systems and ADIRUs and so on. But that could be a good segue into Qantas.
Yes, we'll head off into Qantas.
Yeah, mate, it's been a big week in the news for Qantas. Qantas CEO Alan Joyce has confirmed that there are no plans to merge with any other airlines. He and British Airways CEO Willie Walsh have confirmed the merger with British Airways is dead, gone, kaput. They're not looking at that anymore. Joyce says Qantas is focusing on its core business and getting through the economic crisis. They're also dealing with the impact of swine flu, which has mostly impacted Jetstar, leading to the cancellation of about 30% of their scheduled flights on Japanese routes. Qantas are also delaying take-up of their new aircraft, including 4 A380s, by 12 months, and behind 12 737s by 14 months, which has saved up to $1 billion in capital expenditure in the next financial year. That's a lot of money. They're also reported to be in negotiations with Boeing to delay delivery of their 787s. Qantas are also jettisoning their plans to float their engineering, pilot training, freight, and frequent flyer units. They had been discussing some time back about spinning them off as separate individual units back when things were going really well. Well, surprise, surprise, those plans are all on hold indefinitely or totally cancelled. This has also meant they've cancelled the joint venture with Malaysian Engineering, and they're also moving A330 maintenance back from the Philippines to Australia. So that, of course, has made the local maintenance unions very happy. Alan Joyce also stated they have the utmost confidence in the A330 despite both the Jetstar incident and the Air France crash. This in addition to their own A330 ADIRU hassles that I commented on in the previous podcast that happened to them late last year. Joyce pointed out that Qantas are using pitot systems from a different manufacturer, so they don't have to replace them as Air France and other airlines are racing to do at the moment. Of course, all of this is occurring under the shadow of AirAsia X, seeking to commence flights to Sydney in addition to their current flights into Perth, Melbourne and the Gold Coast. So, yeah, Qantas has been in a bit of a hassle in the last week. They're having a lot of fun dealing with the economic crisis, the swine flu and so on. A big impact that they're having is the fact that they've seen a massive downturn in their premium class, first class and so on. And in fact, they're actually talking about putting some aircraft out there without any first class section at all because it's so empty and just focusing purely on business and standard economy and maybe premium economy.
Yes, well, of course, we love Qantas down here in Australia because without them, there would be no Australia desk report.
Yeah, it's a big part of it, isn't it?
It certainly is. And this next story appeared in the Age newspaper on June the 10th and regards a crash landing of a helicopter up on the Gold Coast up in Queensland. And this is a helicopter crash landed in the Dreamworld theme park car park after losing power while coming into land. The aircraft is a Bell 206 Jet Ranger with four tourists on board, crashed at around 3:55 p.m. All concerned were taken to local hospitals with minor injuries. It's believed the helicopter was in the final stages of landing when it lost power and crashed to the ground and toppled onto its side. The police superintendent praised the pilot for his quick thinking landing in the car park, which, looking at the pictures there, Grant, on the YouTube report, was empty.
Yeah, he chose well. He picked the police were saying he did a very good job steering away from packed areas of the car park and so on and getting into a relatively empty section.
That'll be one Jet Ranger that certainly won't be doing any more joy flights around the Gold Coast.
No, total write-off on that one.
Okay, and there's no Virgin Blue stories to talk about this week. Grant, got anything else
here? Yeah, there actually is another piece here for you, Steve. In fact, I think you're going to enjoy this one, mate. I've also been reading the Age newspaper online, and I found a rather choice piece that segues quite nicely after your comments last week. After some informed destructive comments from the Australia desk last week, Tiger Airlines is reported to have started taking complaints seriously. Yes, according to an article in the Age newspaper, earlier this year, Tiger Airlines was voted the worst domestic airline in Australia for customer service by Choice magazine.
And by this reporter.
Indeed. I was just going to say this position is wholeheartedly supported by yourself and, in fact, many others of us. I personally have not flown on Tiger Airways, but I know some who have. And as I was talking in an email a long time ago, race to the bottom. Anyhow, Tiger is embarking on a campaign to repair its damaged reputation after frequently annoying customers with ancillary charges, poor customer service, and frequent claims of being uncontactable in the event of a flight change or cancellation. You know that one quite well, don't you, Steve?
I know all about that, and on the off chance there is anybody from Tiger Airways listening, I look forward to your reply to my complaint call, which I made back in November. And that'd be good. I mean, in all seriousness, despite my negative experience with them, it's in everybody's interest that they do clean up their act and pick their game up a bit. It's obviously good for consumers. The more airlines we have flying in this country, the better off it's going to be for consumers. So I look forward to them doing better than they have in the past.
Indeed. Come on, Tiger. The only way is up.
The only way is up. And that's about everything from the Australia desk this week. We'll hand it back to the guys. I'm Steve Bisher.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
We'll talk to you all again next week. Bye-bye.
And we thank Steve and Grant for putting that together, as always. Each week, it's great to hear what's going on from the Australia desk. Now, Dan, it turns out these guys have another project they're working on, which is with a guy that runs a 737 simulator. And they've got an interview that they're putting together about that simulator. And they had hoped to have it ready for us, but it's still in production. So they did send along a very short 1 minute kind of teaser for that, and I'd like to play that now.
Sounds good.
The Airplane Geeks Australia desk recently had the fortune to spend a little time in a 737 flight simulator.
Flight 556 is lined up and ready, runway 27. Flight Experience 556 cleared for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff, Flight Experience 556. Good, and now you can activate the auto throttles when you're ready.
Auto throttle, set, thrust.
Good. V1. Rotate.
Rotate. So what we're doing here is we've just done a takeoff from Melbourne, and we're just going to do a circuit here and a landing.
Okay, what's your typical customer profile?
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, you can have, you know, in one day you can have a 12-year-old kid to a 90-year-old man who hasn't flown a plane or a tiger moth, as they'll say, in 65 years, and they come in here and fly this. So it's a dream come true for them.
My background in aviation is I began flying when I was 16.
Well, it was the second time around for me, and every bit as enjoyable as the first time. A real experience and something I'd recommend to anybody.
Well, there you go. That's a bit of fun from a simulator here in Melbourne, Australia. This is Grant McCarran from the Australia Desk.
And I'm Steve Isher, also of the Australia Desk. I'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks again to the guys for that. We're looking forward to the full interview, and hopefully we'll have that soon. Simulators are a fascinating subject. I don't know if you've ever been in a simulator, Dan.
Nope, I'm stuck with Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Sometimes that's as close as it gets.
So my question, though, for you, Max, is what are we going to do then?
Yeah, that's right. We have to do something like that. That's very cool. We have a lot of listener mail. There's really too much to go through in this episode. You may notice that I've been taking a lot of the listener email and posting it to the airplanegeeks.com website as a comment under the most recent podcast episode. So I encourage everyone to go and look there. It's a way that we can get the comments out quickly, and if people want to comment on the comments, they can do that there. There's a number of interesting links to some videos that are out there now and some other points people are making. I did want to mention, though, that Adam has sent us a short MP3 file of the National Biplane Expo. I think we mentioned that in an email last week and took us up on our offer to produce something. So this is Adam's brief report.
Good day, fellow airplane geeks. Adam Fast reporting on the National Biplane Association Expo held in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. This was unfortunately the last year of the Expo, but it went out with a bang. As the name implies, the event centered around anything with two wings, or two sets of wings, rather. Wacos, Stearmans, Fleets, Zeniths, Great Lakes, Starduster 2s, Hatzes, Pitzes, Beaches, they and many more were there. While I didn't formally survey, radial engines and their distinctive sound were in the majority, and there was a steady stream of arrivals and departures as they went up for trip after trip around the patch. Special guests included Dick Rutan, the guest of honor, and John Proctor, who won the longest trip award, bringing his hats on amphibious floats all the way from Oregon at around 65 miles an hour ground speed. Many educational sessions were held, including one of NASA's test pilots for the shuttle carrier aircraft, who spoke about the early shuttle program's development and testing, and a ConocoPhillips rep on the future of GA fuels. Other attractions included biplane rides, which I partook of for the first time and strongly recommend to all, a visit and flights of some T-6s, a T-28, and a Yak in formation, as well as a visit and flights of a B-25. It was a great catalyst to prepare me personally for Oshkosh, and I look forward to geeking out with you all there. A collection of my favorite photos and thoughts can be found on my Tumblr, adamfast.com. For the Airplane Geeks podcast, this is Airplane Geek Adam, wishing you safe flights and endless geekery.
And we thank Adam for that. It's not very difficult, it turns out, to produce something like that. So other listeners, you're all encouraged to capture your thoughts, talk about something that's of interest to Airplane Geeks, and produce it and send it along. Just a couple of quick mentions. Some of the other emails. Rich sent in an email with some links to a three-part spoof documentary about pilots from the BBC show People Like Us. These are some YouTube videos. He mentions they're good for not just pilots, but anyone in the industry, and very funny. You can find those posted on the comments to episode 51. We've had some other comments. Bob sent in listening to episode 51 relative to the Air France crash and the lack of position reports with the maintenance messages. We talked about that last week. There's a system that works for me on my Cessna, the Spot Messenger, for about $150 plus $150 per year. The device sends my GPS position to a low orbit satellite, which sends a text message or plots the positions on a web page. So the technology,
that's cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. He says the technology is not only there, it's cheap. This is a personal tracker. I think what he's got is something that you find at www.findmespot.com. And it's I think it's basically a handheld device that you take with you, and whether you're flying or hiking through the woods or anything else, and it transmits position. I think that's useful for a number of kind of interesting applications, not just aviation. We continue to get some feedback on the length of the show. Sometimes the shows run long, and we've experimented a bit with breaking it up into two parts. And we really get comments on both sides of the scale. Some people, actually quite a lot of people, say keep them long, make them longer, can't get enough. Other people would rather us try to kind of moderate the length of the show. So we'll try to accommodate that. Again, we'd like to thank everybody for the listener mail that's come in. It's really getting overwhelming in a way in terms of the volume. And again, that's why I'm looking to post those on the airplanegeeks.com website so that everyone has an opportunity to see that.
Well, and hopefully I can start some discussions as well. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, please feel free to do just exactly that. We don't have a forum per se, but if the comment activity grows to the point where they know that makes sense, we'll certainly look at doing that. But for now, make use of the comments. The comments are moderated, so if you post a comment, actually I get that and have to allow or disallow the comment. Anything that our listeners send in is almost certainly going to be allowed. What gets disallowed is actually a rather large amount of comment spam that tends to come through. So again, thanks to everybody for submitting the listener feedback. Last week, we read an email from David Vanderhoof. David suggested that we have a This Week in Aviation kind of a feature, and we invited David to maybe step up and provide that history for us. Well, it turns out that David is now the Airplane Geeks designated historian, and he provided the following really very interesting historical perspective on aviation for the upcoming week. David writes, "My fellow Airplane Geeks, greeting from Ridley Park, Pennsylvania, home to all things CH-47. As I write, the smell of warm brownies permeates the neighborhood. Boeing is cooking carbon fiber rotors again." Cool. That's very cool. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 1, Episode 2. This is for June 14th to the 20th, 2009. First, from our Newfoundland desk. Now, on June 14th to 15th, 1919, John Alcock and Arthur Witten Brown took off in a modified Vickers Vimy biplane bomber from Newfoundland, Canada, for the first nonstop flight of the North Atlantic. The flight took approximately 16 and a half hours. The flight was 1,890 miles, which is just over 3,000 kilometers. And the flight was recreated in June 1995 in a replica by none other than Steve Fawcett. Interesting. Another historical item from the past. June 17th, 1928. Amelia Earhart leaves Newfoundland to become the first woman, albeit as a passenger, to fly the Atlantic. The flight was piloted by Wilmer Stoltz, co-piloted by Lewis Gordon. The flight from Trepassey, Newfoundland, to Bury Point, Wales, lasted 20 hours and 40 minutes. Can you imagine that 20-hour flight? I know. The flight was flown on instruments by Stoltz in a Fokker V-11B/3M named Friendship. At the time, Earhart was not certified for instrument flying, but was charged with keeping the logbook. Now, here's an interesting point. When interviewed after landing, she said, "Stoltz did all the flying? Had to. I was just baggage, like a sack of potatoes." That's what Amelia Earhart said. I don't think so. I think that maybe cards, a deck of cards, probably. All right, continuing on in the category of new construction, on June 16th, 1941, the first federally owned airport opened at Gravely Point, Arlington, Virginia. That was Washington National. In fact, Terminal A is on the National Register of Historic Places. In 1987, the airport was relinquished from federal administration and transferred to the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority, who also runs Dulles. On February 6th, 1998, Bill Clinton signed a bill which formally changed the name to Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. In the area of space, we have June 18th, 1977. The space shuttle OV-101 Enterprise carries a crew aloft for the first time. It was fixed to a modified Boeing 747, that being N905NA, originally produced for American Airlines. While researching this, he found that NASA does have a sense of humor. The data instructions on the shuttle mounts say, attach orbiter here. Note, black side down. That's pretty funny. Moving on, another space item. On June 18th, 1983, STS-07 Space Shuttle Challenger launches with a crew of five on its second flight into space. Aboard was Sally K. Ride, Ph.D., making Dr. Ride the first U.S. woman in space. This is June 18th. Coincidentally, Dr. Ride was at the time the youngest U.S. astronaut to go into space. STS-7 was the first mission to use the Canadarm, and Dr. Ride was part of the design staff. It also launched two communication satellites. STS-7 returned to Earth safely on June 24th. A bit more history. This from World War II, June 19th through 20th, 1944, the Battle of Philippine Sea. The Navy downs 346 Imperial Japanese aircraft at a loss of 80 U.S. aircraft. The lopsided battle came to be known as the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot. David McCampbell, the U.S. Medal of Honor award winner, shot down 7 of his 34 total kills for the war on that day in his F-6F-3 Hellcat named Minzy. And then on June 20th, 1941, Army Regulation 95-5 created the USAAF, that's the U.S. Army Air Force, with the U.S. Army Air Corps and General Headquarters Air Forces as its principal parts. But GHQ was dissolved March 9th in 1942, and the Air Corps became a subordinate element of the AAF and continued to exist as a combat arm of the Army until 1947. Some final first flights that occurred during the week of June 14th to 20th. The first flight of the Lockheed F-117 Nighthawk, that was on June 18th, 1941, the stealth fighter. And on June 20th, 1951, first flight of the Bell X-5 Swing Wing X-Plane. And that's the way it was. That's from June 14th to the 20th. And we'd like to thank David, our new airplane geek historian, for supplying that. And look forward to more reports in the future. Okay, just wanted to mention as we start to close this episode that next week we're going to have an exciting episode. We're going to have a number of people who have been or who are at the Paris Air Show right now as we record this.
I'm jealous.
I know. I wish I was going to be there. But we're going to have quite a collection of past airplane geeks, guests, people in the industry, people that and read of and read about often. So we're looking forward to that. It's going to be kind of a roundtable sort of format, I think. And we're looking forward to that.
And one thing that I'm really looking forward to, hopefully on Monday, if my flights are on time, I will be interviewing Southwest Airlines CEO Gary Kelly. So hopefully that'll be up on the podcast next week as well.
Fantastic. Really looking forward to that. If you'd like to reach us, you can send us an email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. If you'd like, you can leave us a voicemail. That number is area code in the U.S. 812-757-4252. You can follow us on Twitter as Airplane Geeks. And if you go to the airplanegeeks.com website, besides leaving comments there, you can order an Airplane Geeks t-shirt. We actually continue to get some more submissions for ideas for the t-shirt, and we hope to be able to incorporate those into some t-shirt designs. So you'll all be able to take a look at those and purchase those t-shirts. I guess that's pretty much it. Dan, where can people find you online?
You can visit my daily blog at www.thingsinthesky.com, and you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Dan Webbage, DanWebbage.
And you can follow me on Twitter as Max Flight. I encourage everyone to do that and participate in that forum. I think that wraps it up for this episode. Dan, unless you've got anything else?
No.
Okay, so we'll see you next week for episode 53 of the Airplane Geeks podcast, our Paris Air Show wrap-up. Bye, everybody.
Thanks very much, guys, for listening. Da 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 da.